Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Steve Goldstein. I'm Lauren Gilger. Thank you for listening this morning. Coming up on the show today, the Arizona Corporation Commissioners got their chance to grill APS CEO Don Brandt. We'll hear more about that. And how Chinese Americans feel caught in the crossfire as U.S. suspicion of China rises.
But first, Governor Doug Ducey has named Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery to the state Supreme Court. The governor made the announcement yesterday via Twitter, framing Montgomery as a justice who will, quote, interpret the law, not someone who wants to write the law, end quote. No one seemed especially surprised by the selection, with the rumors that came well ahead of the announcement alleging Montgomery's appointment was inevitable. And Montgomery's supporters and detractors alike have been quick to respond. Joining us now to talk about the governor's fifth appointment to the court is High Ground's Doug Cole and executive director of the ACLU of Arizona, Alessandro Soler. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning.
So, Alessandro, let me just start with you. Just quick reaction to this, because in some sense, certainly Bill Montgomery has been controversial, but even in the sense that he has been an elected official, that is something we rarely see.
Right. This is a politician. He's been a politician for 9 years here, and I think we were... we think that the governor selected the least qualified candidate. This is a politician who has shown during his tenure that he cannot disregard his own personal biases when making these decisions that impact the most important, legal office, as Doug was saying, in the state. You know, this is an individual who has marginalized communities. He has refused to process paperwork for gay couples. He's brought in anti-Muslim activists to train his officials. I mean, he's got a long history of going after medical marijuana patients, and I think we believe that he's got a destructive civil liberties record and doesn't belong on the court.
And Doug, let's go to you next with your reaction from sort of the other side of the aisle.
Well, as Steve said in his intro, this is an appointment that's been long expected. In fact, I think the bigger news this morning would be that he didn't get appointed to the Supreme Court. But this is a person that has a very long record as county attorney, and that's what's unusual. We know a lot about Bill Montgomery, unlike other previous appointees to the Supreme Court. And so his record's out there for all to see, and the governor's office is well aware, has vetted him, and this governor has been nothing but consistent on his judicial appointments, especially to the Supreme Court. This is number five. No other governor in Arizona history has appointed five Supreme Court justices. Most governors appoint two, maybe three. And the other interesting aspect of this is every one of his appointments, save Justice Bullock, is in their early to mid-50s. Mm-hmm. That means we have a mandatory retirement age of 70 years old. That means that this governor's influence is going to be apparent on the court for the least the next 15 to 20 years. I think that's a big story in and of itself.
Well, and that brings us back to the idea of adding the two justices, which is going to be even more impactful. Alessandro, generally, we knew that this was going to be obviously a relatively conservative appointment. Right. The fact that it is Montgomery and the fact that we know more of his record, does that necessarily mean he's going to end up being a more troublesome justice to progressives?
Well, it's been interesting because the Supreme Court has generally been good on criminal justice issues, and Clint Bullock, Justice Bullock, has been very, when we've appeared before the court on these issues, we've generally had favorable decisions. And so he's going to be one of seven. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I mean, I think the bigger concern for us is the county attorney, right? I mean, this is a very, very important, powerful position. The county attorney decides who goes to prison for how long. And I think it's going to be important for voters to really understand and demand a fair process.
And as we look forward, Doug, to the future on the court, like you're getting at here, I mean, this is now an all-Republican court, I understand. Is that out of the ordinary, and what might that mean? Both of you can tackle this, actually.
Well, no, it's not out of the ordinary. Back when Bruce Babbitt, the three-term governor here in the state, Stanley Feldman was the longtime chief justice. That court was very Democratic and was left to center. You've had a Governor Brewer with her 6 years in office, and now you're going to have 8 years of Governor Ducey, between those two governors that succeeded Janet Napolitano, the overwhelming majority of all the courts that are in marriage selection are going to be right of center, mm-hmm. justices, more conservatives. I mean, that's just how the process works. Look, elections have consequences. The voters of this state voted Doug Ducey in 14, and they reelected him in 2018. So, and part of being governor is getting to make these judicial appointments, and that's their legacy.
But let's pick at this a bit. We don't have a lot of time, but I want to pick at the Montgomery choice, Doug, mm-hmm. because, Doug Ducey won reelection very easily. It seems like an odd calculation, though, when you consider he could have nominated some relatively anonymous judge who may have been just as conservative. Why would he delve into these waters? Is there something going on behind the scenes? Are they closer than we thought? What's going on there?
Well, I think, as with Justice Bullock, I think that he has a relationship with the county attorney, and he knows that these appointments are legacies. Are legacy issues, and I think that he's comfortable with Bill, and he knows him well, and his record's out there for everyone to see, and he, like I said earlier, he's been nothing but consistent on the type of person he has put on the Supreme Court.
I mean, I would think this is a textbook example of cronyism, right? And I think this is what's interesting is that this is going to be, Montgomery has had national media attention for a lot of the policies that are coming out of his office. And so it's going to be interesting to see if the media continues to sort of focus that spotlight on him and see how he performs as a justice. But, I would agree with Doug that the courts are generally have been conservative, not just here in Arizona, across the country. And when it comes to a lot of the issues that we bring to them, I mean, they're generally going to be on the right side of history, and the courts understand a lot of these. They're complicated legal issues.
Yeah, but he went to West Point. It's hard to get into West Point. He graduated magna cum laude from Arizona State University School of Law. This is an individual who is a pretty big intellect. Now, you can disagree with some of his decisions and his policies, but this is a smart man.
Okay, so final question we probably have time for. There's now the matter of who will take Montgomery's place in the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. Your organization, Alessandra, said this is an open race now. What kinds of qualities are you looking for?
Well, we're looking for somebody that's going to investigate prosecutorial misconduct. The Arizona Supreme Court has just said that one of Montgomery's chief prosecutors engaged in misconduct. So we want somebody who's going to be open and transparent, is going to investigate misconduct and hold these prosecutors accountable. We want somebody who recognizes that there's a problem, that we need to reduce the number of people we send to prison. Arizona has one of the highest incarceration rates in the country, and Bill has been fueling that incarceration crisis by sending more people to prison for longer periods. And we also want somebody who acknowledges that there are racial disparities in the criminal justice system and tries to make an effort to reduce those disparities.
All county officers are up next year, whether you're a supervisor or an assessor or the county attorney or the sheriff. So Mr. Montgomery would have had to run next year in any case. I think the county board of supervisors are going to be very transparent in his appointment process, who replaces him. I think that they'll probably have some citizens group that they will put together, would be my anticipation, and vet candidates. And ultimately, it's up to the five elected county board members of the County Board of Supervisors.
All right, Doug Cole of High Ground and Alessandra Soler, Executive Director of the ACLU Arizona. Thank you both.
Thanks for having
Thanks.
Us.
There was a showdown at the Arizona Corporation Commission yesterday as commissioners grilled CEO of Pinnacle West, the parent corporation of Arizona Public Service, APS. For more than 6 hours, commissioners grilled Don Brandt about his company's policies on a wide range of issues, from disconnecting service to secretly funding political campaigns and communication with its customers. Brandt's soon-to-be successor, Jeff Goldner, didn't get away without a moment in the spotlight either. Commission Chairman Bob Burns has long had qualms with the company's political spending, and he wanted Goldner to signal an end to those activities, a signal Goldner was not willing to send.
I would ask that you make a public commitment here today and now that during your tenure in that position, or positions that you would not permit or allow the companies to be participants in any election of any corporation commissioner?
I'm not in the role yet, Mr. Chairman, and so I'm not in a position today to answer that question.
Ryan Randazzo with the Arizona Republic was at yesterday's hearing and joins us now. Good morning, Ryan.
Morning.
So let's start with that. There were a variety of accusations laid out here by the commissioners, but let's start with political spending and this response from the incoming CEO. Was that a surprising answer from your point of view?
It wasn't. You know, APS has said that they didn't start doing what was being discussed, spending money in corporation commission elections, until the solar industry started backing its own candidates. And they say their hand was forced, that the solar industry was supporting Vernon Parker and Lucy Mason in 2014. Those candidates were likely to support continued subsidies for rooftop solar, and that would be unsustainable for APS and its customers, and that they had to sort of push their preferred candidates. Well, many customers don't like the idea of a utility choosing who sets its rates, but it did not surprise me that they would not commit to never doing that again, because if a candidate was being supported again by the rooftop solar industry or anything else, you know, the wind turbine industry, and they wanted to build wind turbines that APS thought would be uneconomical, they would definitely probably fight that.
Ryan, the company's vice president of public affairs, Jessica Pacheco, was brought up as far as being part of all this strategy related to spending. And considering for the public generally, I think they're more concerned probably about rates and the shutoff policy. Did it seem, what was the atmosphere like, considering that certain members of the commission were certainly directly targeted by APS? Did this have a different vibe to it because of something like that?
Yeah, well, that did surprise me, to be honest, because they were bringing up a decade-old scandal where Jessica Pacheco worked for a consultancy, and she pitched something to Don Brandt that I don't know how else to describe it aside from being deeply unethical. They proposed spending millions of dollars to create fake controversies, to drum up public opposition to elected officials so that the state would vote to appoint those people and basically take away, you know, what's in our Constitution to have a corporation commission. Now, Don Brandt said he didn't like that idea, but he hired Jessica Pacheco anyways, and now she runs, you know, the public policy strategy over there. So I was surprised that after a decade that was getting sort of brought up again. The Arizona Republic reported that. I had help from Robert Englund back in 2013, and we got a copy of that proposal from Jessica and confronted APS with it, and it didn't seem to get a ton of traction at the time. So I'm a little shocked in 2019 that, you know, Robert Burns, the commission chairman, has been holding on to that and waiting, you know, to sort of lob that at Don Brandt when he got him in the commission chambers.
And the governor was dragged into that as well, right? There were a few questions and mentions about the governor's role.
Yeah, and that's been simmering in the background of the commission for years, that the Ducey administration has somehow tried to force their will upon the commission. You folks had me in here several months ago, and the governor had made a really bizarre comment that the Corporation Commission was sort of having mission creep and doing things they weren't entitled to do. Well, the commission hasn't lost a lawsuit when they pass renewable energy standards or those things, so they clearly have the authority to do that. But, you know, the governor has gotten to appoint people to the commission who clearly have carried out his desires there. Commissioner Andy Tobin came in with this proposal to sort of give away the duties of the Corporation Commission to other state departments, which would have given that power to Doug Ducey. So Ducey appointed someone who went to the commission and tried to give more power to the governor. It's pretty complicated, but yeah, that seemed to really offend not only Commissioner Burns, but some other folks down there as well.
All right, let's move away from politics briefly here. So one of the questions was asked of Don Brandt as far as how the utility had handled the rate plan changes, which caused a lot of angst for some folks. Here's what Don Brandt had to say.
You know, we send them materials, as does SRP and the websites, et cetera, and other communications, and it doesn't resonate with a lot of people.
Now, this is something Don Brandt and Jeff Goldner sort of disagreed about, whether the utility had done enough to inform customers what they were going to be facing.
Yeah, and that was, really skirting the issue, you know, there was a customer complaint over that rate hike. Stacey Champion filed a complaint that got hearings. The judge who oversaw that complaint determined that APS did such a terrible job explaining these complicated rates that they should have to cough up $5 million to help educate people and teach them what these rates are, because that's how difficult they are to understand. That ended up not happening. The commissioners decided they weren't going to force APS to spend that money, but they are forcing this continued education program for a rate hike now that's 2 years old, and people still are struggling with it. So it was sort of, I thought, skirting the facts of that case.
All right, that's the Arizona Republic's Ryan Randazzo. Ryan, thank you so much for coming in.
Sure.
Earlier this week on the show, we told you about 9 Chinese students at Arizona State University who were returning to the U.S. for the new school year when they were detained by customs officers at Los Angeles International Airport and sent back to China. This comes at a time when tensions between the U.S. and China are intensifying and suspicion towards China here is spreading. Just this summer, NPR reported that U.S. intelligence agencies are encouraging some universities to monitor students and visiting scholars from institutions affiliated with the Chinese state. So how are Chinese Americans responding to all of this? For more on that perspective, I got a hold of Charlie Wu. He is CEO of toy manufacturer Megatoys and a public policy chairman of Committee 100, a national organization of leading Chinese Americans.
I think in the last 40 years, until 2 or 3 years ago, the American establishment and Chinese establishment encourage constructive dialogue and interaction and exchanges. Last several years, because each side accused the other side of changing their position, both sides seem to take a more hostile and vigilant attitudes against each other, and they become competitive. So many Chinese Americans are caught, and I think that's a problem here. And because of that, when you look at threats from China to be a whole of society threat, then sometimes, the public are confused between foreigners from China, with Chinese Americans that have been, here either as a new immigrants, but, could be 5 or 6 generations. Yeah. So anytime when you have a situation where 9 Chinese students are not permitted to enter the country, we don't know the reason yet. So it's really difficult to comment. But that adds to the rumors, the speculations, and anxiety that all Chinese Americans or all people of Chinese descent in this country need to be really careful as to whether they become a target of investigation or not.
So you represent this National Organization of Chinese Americans who are not necessarily the ones, being investigated here, but feeling the repercussions, right? So what does that feel like from your perspective and from the perspective of the community? What are you hearing from folks?
I mean, certainly there's a lot of anxiety and people are not quite sure how to react. And there are several levels of concern. So one is particularly for those that have been actively engaged in scientific exchanges, cultural exchanges. Now they become, worried. And, whatever they have done in the past that they thought was positive, productive, and encouraged now could be viewed as a completely different light. And for all of us that have friends and relatives in China, we go visit and they come visit us. And there's a certain level of concern whether anything we do, anything we say would be suspicious to, the American authority. And, as a minority group, I think we have been victimized by paranoia and fear of foreigners, in the last 150 years.
Tell us a little bit about some of the history behind this and if what's happening now is bringing up some of those memories.
Yes, it certainly has, but I'm not saying that this is as bad as it was. For Chinese Americans during the late 1800s, because when the American railroad workers finished the project and there were too many of them and created a social problem. And so it caused government to enact a Chinese Exclusion Act, sort of not allowing any ethnic immigrants from China to enter the United States. And those that are in the country are subjected to really severe oppression. Mm-hmm. Generations later, we still sort of feel the impact of that. And then, of course, you have the Japanese-American internment during World War II.
Yeah.
Many of those Japanese-American were loyal American citizens, but they were sort of put in a internment camp because fear of them turning to spies for Japan, our enemy. So it just, you know, bring back memories of those terrible, terrible experiences from the past. And, you know, we just hope that history won't repeat itself in the current era.
So on the flip side of this, though, I mean, there has to be a balance, yeah. right? Because the espionage from the Chinese yeah. government has happened in the U.S. I mean, how do we make sure that we protect against those things, but also don't, you know, catch people, the vast majority of people here of Chinese descent who are not involved in anything like that at all?
Yeah, no, that's always really important that Americans are cooperative in working together to protect our advantage, right? I mean, our technology, the research, but that has to be done through education. You know, many involved in research and exchanges need to be really careful. They have to conduct themselves differently because it's a different political era. And I think in enforcing the law and regulations and protecting America, I think the establishment needs to be a little bit sensitive that they don't go overboard, and they should target bad behavior, not, you know, targeting an entire group just because where they come from, where their parents might come from. You know, I'm an immigrant myself. I came to this country because I believe that it offers equal opportunity to everybody. And in this country, we are judged by what we do, how we contribute to society, not where we come from or where our parents came from. That's what is attractive to all the immigrants that want to come here and contribute. And that's really the American advantage. Mm-hmm. And we need to maintain that. At the same time, you know, protect our national security secrets and advantage. So it is a really tough balancing act. What we like to call is just some consideration, because when you overdo it and target a broad group of people with a broad stroke, it could have a negative impact, and ultimately it could damage the Americans' advantage in the global competition.
All right. That's Charlie Wu, an international entrepreneur, the CEO of Megatoys and public policy chairman of Committee 100, a national organization of leading Chinese Americans.
It's been clear for a number of years that the state's institutions of higher learning are a driving force in the economy, with a lot of credit recently going to ASU for the impact the downtown Phoenix campus has had. Grand Canyon University's decision to expand what it's doing in the West Valley has helped revive certain nearby areas. And based on reporting by the Phoenix Business Journal, developers and other businesses, many tech-focused, want to work with ASU, GCU, U of A, and NAU on construction and building projects. Karina Vanek covers commercial real estate and the economy for the Business Journal and is with me. Karina, what are commercial developers saying about their relationships with the universities? Has this been a real boon for them?
So far, we're pretty early in the process, so it looks like developers are very excited to be on university campuses, particularly the ones that are working on ASU campus in the Novus corridor. That's on the northeast side of campus. They are really excited to be part of it. The projects are very new, but they are happy to have the opportunity.
And explain what Novus is.
So Novus is the Arizona State University Athletic Facilities District. It's designated by the state legislature, and they can have commercial development, private interest on university land, and that pays fees to the university, and the fees in turn fund athletics.
So are there certain realms so far that have, in terms of the type of business, I would think technology would be pretty popular. What are you seeing as far as that goes?
So yes, from what we've heard, tech companies are the ones that are most interested in locating at university campuses. They want to be where there's talent coming out all the time. They want to be where the cutting edge research is. So technology companies are dying to be near universities, especially in Tempe.
SkySong comes to mind for me. Does that sort of fit into the same thing? SkySong has a little bit of a leap ahead. It's been there for several years now.
Right. So SkySong is one of ASU's innovation zones, as is Novus. The Arizona State University Research Park in South Tempe is also one. So they're in kind of the same bubble, but different kind of uses.
Can you compare and contrast what ASU and Grand Canyon are doing?
So they're kind of different animals, but GCU right now is in a growth mode, but most of their growth is student facing. So they just came up with three new dorms that are opening this year for the academic year, and they have three more planned. So a lot of what they're looking at is actually accommodating their growing student body.
Any idea whether that's a long-term plan or is that just a sort of short-term?
So Brian Mueller, the president of Grand Canyon, told us that they are looking at probably a steady stream of new dorms in the foreseeable future. So they're looking at probably similar volume of new dormitories on campus for the next few years.
When it comes to U of A and NAU, mm-hmm. it seems like there's less development.
Is it because ASU and GCU are focused in the Valley where much of the population growth has taken place?
So I would say that NAU certainly does have less, but I think it's because they finished a lot of construction pretty recently. They just opened their new aquatics and tennis center and their science and health building. So they were in growth mode for a while. I think that's slowed a little bit just as things have come through. U of A is also kind of in a growth mode, but maybe not so much that we see in Phoenix. They are undertaking a big project called their Student Success Corridor. It's revitalization of a lot of old buildings on campus, so it's not really new construction, but it'll be very central in campus. They also are building an honors dormitory. They said that maybe they'll even look at another one very soon because they have had a lot of demand for those.
Okay. And how do sports facilities in the bigger sense fit into it? We're seeing renovation at Sendeville Stadium, but GCU has facilities as well that I know they're involved with.
GCU has quite a few. Also, U of A has quite a few. And I know that NAU has one coming down the pike that's not quite under construction yet, but a little bit more in the conceptual stages. So sports facilities are a big deal right now. I know that ASU, with that Novus project that's going to generate all this money for athletics, is going to create an athletics village. It's going to replace some of the athletic facilities that will be torn down because of Novus. The baseball stadium is going away. They moved to the Phoenix Municipal Stadium, but they're going to redo tennis and track and some other sports facilities over there. Grand Canyon just opened their outdoor hockey arena, and they also have a new sports facility that's going to be used for intramurals, club sports, and students that may be not involved in actual university-sanctioned athletics that want to use them.
How have the universities approached leadership on this? I mean, when you have people who are involved in some of these major decisions, the people who are calling the shots, are these people with commercial real estate experience?
I think there's a pretty good mix. I know that there's a master developer for Novus specifically. It's Catalyst Development, and they are doing kind of the horizontal construction to prepare for, you know, new buildings to go in. So they kind of have that master plan feel. U of A does most of their own, so they have planning and master planning within the university, and they hire their own contractors and things. Grand Canyon, same thing. They have a little bit of things going on within the university as well as, you know, outside construction.
It really seems, based on the reporting you and your colleagues did, that what's going on with universities, I'll stick with ASU and GCU at this point, are really in a lot of ways driving certain aspects of growth. From the folks you talk to, how big a deal is this that there is so much progress involved and connected to the two universities?
It's such a big deal. We didn't get into talking about ASU downtown very much, but that's another place where the university came into an area that maybe needed a little bit more work being done and really sparked a lot of development. So I think that a lot of people give the universities a lot of credit for pointing attention at a certain area, investing in that spot, and making that a place that people want to be. Even though the area around Grand Canyon isn't full of office, most of it's residential, a lot of companies have been asking brokers, you know, can I get in near GCU? So people are interested. They're looking at these things.
Karina Vanek of the Phoenix Business Journal, good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Great. Thank you for having me.
You are listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
So my name is Edward Machacik, and I am the head knight here at the Arizona Medieval Times. We're expected to be stuntmen, equestrians, cold fighters, and athletes at the same time, you know, and actors.
Who then, my lords, deems himself mightiest in skill? Who shall claim the first challenge?
The jousting is probably my favorite stunt. The difficult part in that is simply to keep the horses on the rail, and then slowly it's almost like you're reading each other's minds. If you just think you want to go left and they start turning with you, or if you want them to go faster, they pick it up with you. When I first started, I was actually scared of horses, so it's a little leap from there.
That's Edward Machacik training the performers at the Scottsdale Medieval Times. If you have suggestions or hear things that makes Phoenix Phoenix, or you want us to knight you, send us a note at theshow@kjzz.org.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to the show. In Phoenix, I'm Steve Goldstein with Lauren Gilger. Stay tuned. Coming up this morning at 10, we'll have the takeaway.
The National Collegiate Athletic Association, or NCAA, has done research indicating that a significant percentage, nearly half of student-athletes, have experienced clinical or subclinical levels of anxiety. And the percentage is even higher when it comes to depression. So what are some of the greatest mental health challenges for student-athletes, and how can they deal with the issue? With me to talk about that is Alex Auerbach, who's Director of Clinical and Sports Psychology Services in the U of A's Athletic Department. Alex, we know any student can have mental health issues or concerns. How differently do those manifest themselves for student-athletes?
Student-athletes certainly face this greater additional pressure to constantly be on and constantly be performing in all the various domains of their life as a student-athlete, because there are sort of minimum expectations there they have for academic performance. There are minimum expectations they have for athletic performance and for things that sort of other college students just wouldn't have that same expectation. You know, as a great example, if a student-athlete misses class, everybody knows about it. In the department, and that student athlete's held accountable. If a regular undergraduate student, if you will, misses class, there's essentially no consequence unless the teacher has something built into place. But I think if you take that microcosm and you blow it up over the course of the whole sort of college career, what that amounts to is a fairly large discrepancy in perceived pressure to be on and be performing. And then that manifests itself as stress. And then that comes out in all sorts of mental health related ways.
How about the stress that is just related to a schedule and balancing a schedule? Because let's say a college student has a job, and many do, but some don't, and they can focus on their studies. When it comes to being a student athlete, expectations are very high that you're almost performing sort of two jobs, right? You're going to class and you also need to excel in your sport. Does that sort of thing manifest a different kind of stress? Also, just feeling overscheduled and not being able to necessarily be at your best, because how are you going to balance your time and take care of all those things you need to take care of?
Absolutely. You know, I think people will say that being a student athlete really is like a full-time job. I think it might be more like a full-time job and a half, because most of them take, you know, full academic course loads and then are in, you know, this sort of mandatory 20 hours of season. It manifests itself in a few ways that I think are important. You know, one is student athletes often feel like they don't have time to develop themselves outside of athletics. And so then what we tend to see is when sport is taken away from a student athlete, whether that's career-ending injury or graduation, or, you know, family stuff goes on back home and the student athlete's forced to move home and support family, this loss of athletic identity can really be impactful for that student athlete. And it brings up, again, sort of this different kind of almost identity crisis between the ages of 18 and 22. And they're asking the question, who am I outside of this sport? Student athletes don't often feel like they have the opportunity to have an off day, essentially, you know, but we all have bad days. So we all have days when we can't perform our best. But if you have a bad day in the classroom and then a bad day at practice, you're going to know about it and you're going to hear about it in a way that maybe another person wouldn't. And I think that there's a perception that there's almost no room for error. There's no room to be human, and that you're going to be sort of pushed to be your best and be at your max capacity every day. When the reality is that sometimes the best we can give is 80% of our 100%.
I know you talk with student athletes about what comes next. And I was even thinking about how the emotional state that must result when, you know, we hear about professional athletes, and obviously very few people make it to that level, but those that they're 31, sure. Or even what just happened with Andrew Luck, the quarterback of the Colts, deciding at 29 that based on the mental weight of having all those injuries, the physical injuries really, really weighed on him, which makes sense. Is it difficult, especially in a sport where it's clear the person is not going to make, let's say, the next level, whether it's Olympics or professional sports and that kind of thing? What is it like dealing with almost like that mini death when you're 21? It's almost like, well, I pursued this up until I'm 21, and now abruptly that's really over.
A lot of college is about figuring out who you are. You know, who am I away from family? Who am I in this new place? Who am I on this team? And then I think when an athlete transitions out of sport and that's taken away, and Andrew Luck's a great example, it's like, you know, who am I now that I don't play football anymore? Or who am I, you know, now that college is over and I'm not going to go be a, like, gymnasts, I think, are a great example. You know, when a gymnastics student athlete gets to us here at the university level, it's very, very likely that their career is essentially over even at that point. Because like Olympic gymnasts are so young, and the peak of that sort of sport performance is really almost before college. And so then when it kind of wraps up, that truly is the end. And there are certainly exceptions to the rule, but I think they all ask, you know, what does it mean now that I'm not a student athlete anymore? Who am I without my sport? I do liken that process to a grief and loss process. You know, this, it's almost the same experience we'd go through when we lose a loved one.
Alex, how generally willing or unwilling are student athletes to seek mental health care? And I hate to throw in the word stigma, but is there much less of a stigma attached to it now? Can there be a greater degree of openness?
I think, you know, some of the work that professional athletes are doing right now, you know, Kevin Love is a great example, sort of speaking up and raising awareness about mental health, I think is certainly contributing to a reduced stigma. And then I think, you know, here at University of Arizona, where there's been a practitioner in my position for, you know, the better part of a decade, if not longer now, for us, the stigma certainly seems to be going away. We have numbers wise about 50% of our student athletes, you know, come by and see us over the course of their academic year. And that can range from anything from sort of adjustment stuff, anxiety, depression, substance use, all the way to, hey, how do I get more out of my sport? How do I focus better in class? How do I sleep better? How do I manage all these different challenges that I'm facing? And so we're certainly seeing the stigma reduce. I wouldn't say it's totally gone, but it's on the way out.
Alex Auerbach is the Director of Clinical and Sports Psychology Services in the U of A's Athletic Department.
In vitro fertilization, or IVF, has revolutionized family planning. Couples or individuals struggling to become parents can turn to IVF when there don't seem to be any other options left. The procedure is costly, but that doesn't stop tens of thousands of families from undergoing the procedure each year. However, the practice is largely unregulated by the feds, and state officials here in Arizona don't regulate it either, and that is the norm across the country. Those few states that do regulate it are often lax and filled with loopholes. For more on this, I got a hold of Dr. Dove Fox, a bioethics professor at the University of San Diego and author of a book about IVF. And I asked him first what the landscape looks like now in the country when it comes to regulation of IVF facilities. Is there any?
The regulatory landscape is very sparse, both at the state and federal level, and then in other less formal ways, like professional organizations. There's no state law that tells IVF clinics how they have to perform certain procedures or what kind of safety or reliability mechanisms or protocols they're supposed to use. And the states don't have any rules about that either. Professional organizations do provide guidelines about how many embryos to implant, for example, or what are the more reliable methods of screening and testing embryos or sperm or eggs. But those recommendations are just that. They're completely voluntary, and there's no information we have even about how routinely they are followed or ignored. There's no real teeth to them, except insofar as the organizations can say one clinic or another can't continue to be a member in good standing. But there isn't a good sense of how much that really matters.
So if an IVF facility had a really poor record or had made some catastrophic mistake at some point, no state or federal authorities would be able to go in and shut them down?
So at the federal level, it would be the Food and Drug Administration. But the only federal law that is relevant, a 1992 law, which asks these clinics to provide information about success rates, explicitly carves out IVF clinics in terms of their practices and procedures, says that the FDA doesn't have authority to tell them what to do.
So how does this compare then to other countries where things like this are pretty heavily regulated? And what do those regulations look like there?
So some other countries, most developed ones, take assisted reproduction a lot more seriously. In the United Kingdom, there is a federal agency whose job it is to do clinic visits and provide rules and regulations about how to perform procedures safely, reliably, and they track and inform the public about how things are going. The way it works in this country, even after a catastrophic event like these multiple embryo switches or cases in which these large freezers fail, destroying hundreds or even thousands of people's reproductive materials, is lawmakers at the state level may feel like they want to try to enact a law. And in certain limited cases, that has been successful within narrow scope. So, for example, Indiana and Texas have recently enacted regulations against so-called fertility fraud, where doctors have used their own sperm to inseminate fertility patients. Mm-hmm. But even when this happens, they don't enact any larger kinds of rules that address many, many other different kinds of problems that arise that a larger agency or broader rules would be able to, like they have in other countries.
So can you give us a sense of why this is? Like, why is it that this industry is less regulated than many others?
Lawmakers and the public are wary of government involvement in reproduction. There's a fear that with increased regulation in the technology of procreation may come limits on who gets to be a parent or what kinds of children are created. And you see those kinds of restrictions in countries like France and Austria, which limit the use of these techniques to different sex married couples and exclude certain groups. And so there is some fear that any involvement may open the door to those sorts of restrictions on reproduction with all the history that comes with that. Mm-hmm. Another reason why regulation is slow in this area has to do with the peculiar history of assisted reproduction in this country. The government got out of the business of funding this medical research, and with that, a hands-off approach in how the practice proceeded.
So it doesn't sound like there's any sort of groundswell effort at a federal level or on a broader level to change this. What would you like to see happen? I mean, how would this look in your ideal world?
Lauren, you said it just right. In the absence of a groundswell effort, something like we saw more than a century ago for workers' compensation in response to employment injuries, or insurance for auto crashes when automobiles were less safe than they are today. At least at the federal level, you would need to see that kind of outpouring of advocacy on behalf of the public to overcome the barriers to regulation in this area. Otherwise, the states could take the mantle, but ideally in ways that brought more systemic change. Finally, you might have a professional regulation enforced in a way that made it matter to clinics whether they abided by the kinds of protocols and guidelines that these groups put forward.
All right, that's Dr. Dove Fox with the University of San Diego and author of Birth Rights and Wrongs, How Medicine and Technology Are Remaking Reproduction and the Law. Dr. Fox, thank you for joining us to talk about this.
Thanks so much for having me.
Arizona and its cities have been working on ways to help residents deal with the heat for years, but a new report points out that those heat mitigation efforts and concerns about urban heat islands are no longer confined to the Southwest. Scorched, put out by the Urban Land Institute, says rising temps and dangerous heat waves are now reality across the country. Ladd Keith was a reviewer on the report. He's an assistant professor in planning at the University of Arizona, and he spoke with our co-host, Mark Brody.
How widespread is it across the U.S. that cities and developers and realtors are starting to think about these issues now?
Traditionally, it has been an issue that people have thought about more impacting places like the Southwest. But just this summer alone, during the July heat wave, we had 128 million people in the United States under excessive heat warnings. So absolutely, cities across the nation are thinking about extreme heat in a more serious way now.
Well, so how are cities trying to think about this and take measures to try to reduce some of the problems here?
Yeah, so it depends on where they're located. Cities in the Southwest might be looking at things like increasing shade and increasing the amount of urban forestry that we have. Other cities that are more dense, like New York City, that I've been working with, have much different strategies where they might be thinking about kind of their older building stock and how to better insulate those buildings, and thinking about apartment controls and things like the feasibility of requiring landlords to have a maximum temperature that's allowed in the city. So it depends on where you're at in the country and kind of what people are acclimated to.
Are there certain methods that are kind of universal? I'm thinking about things maybe like cool roofs and different colored pavement, things like that, that sort of wherever you go reduce the heat, even if maybe you don't feel it quite so much, it still has that kind of effect?
Yeah, so that was a big thing that we looked at when we put the report together for the Urban Land Institute was there are things that are just so context specific for different cities, but what were those universal things that kind of everyone learning about extreme heat for the first time can look at implementing in those in their cities? And one thing was increasing shade and kind of considering using trees that in the summertime have a large canopy. Another thing that's universal is looking at better coordination with the different government agencies like public health officials and urban planners. And that's something that's kind of universal across the country too, is just better coordinating those services related to extreme heat.
Are you finding that cities or other types of governments are taking a look at this and maybe implementing, for example, building codes or other kinds of regulations? Or are you finding this sort of typically coming from the market itself?
Yeah, so that was another thing that was really interesting about putting the report together was a lot of it was driven by the public sector and the governments looking at ways that they could get ahead of the climate impacts that are coming. But then a lot of the interest, too, was from real estate developers, property financers and insurers that were looking at ways to make their land developments more profitable over time and really seeing extreme heat as something that, if not planned for well, could actually lead to an economic cost for them.
It's interesting, and the report does spend a lot of time talking about sort of the financial and fiscal impacts here. It seems as though the fact that real estate developers are spending so much time and energy looking at this, it almost seems to indicate that that buyers and residents of different cities sort of get the problem here and want those developers and others to sort of try to deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was something that we looked at. So kind of at the macro scale, you have large cities that want to remain economically competitive with each other. And so they're looking at ways that they can continue to provide the quality of life for residents and attract new residents and new businesses. But then even at the site specific scale for land developers, things that will attract potential feet on the ground. And so is your property going to be an outdoor mall that's comfortable to be in the summer, or is it going to be too hot and it'll drive the consumers away? So that's the way that real estate developers are thinking about it, for sure.
One of the most striking things in this report was a graphic that was in there, the top 10 most intense urban heat islands, and it was between 2004 and 2013. And the thing that really struck me is under the worst daytime urban heat island, Phoenix is not in the top 10.
Yeah, correct. And if you think about it, it's logical because our deserts aren't heavily forested. You know, there's not a lot of vegetation or anything and a lot of our surrounding environments in places like Phoenix and Tucson. But some other places that are maybe have more temperate forest or had more vegetation to start with the built environment that's been put in place there, it definitely has a lot greater difference between the temperatures in the urban and the rural areas.
How much of what needs to happen and what folks are talking about doing is stuff that can sort of be done in the short term in terms of, you know, maybe planting more trees, putting up shade, things like that, maybe different colored asphalt? And how much of it really comes down to how a city is built and the types of buildings there are and might be more of a long-term kind of fix?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that's what people are grappling with right now is you know, as we continue to see more heat waves and more events, July of this year was just named the hottest month ever recorded. And so I think as we continue to see those, people will be looking at that question very carefully. But I think we have existing cities that have been built over hundreds of years. And so some of that will be hard to change. But the question is how we can use the resources that we have to implement changes that will make the greatest cost benefit. And so here in Tucson, we're actually, our parks department is going through a process of a voter-approved bond to install splash pads at different parks around the city. And it's kind of the first time that we've had the money to put splash pads kind of all over the city. And so I think we'll see more adaptations like that happening to provide cool places for people to enjoy themselves.
Would you anticipate that going forward, the solutions that cities are looking at continue to be sort of unique to each one or maybe regional, as opposed to some new idea or new technology coming down the pike that could be sort of universally adapted across the country?
Yeah, so I think it'll be a mix of both. So there'll be those universal things like shade that'll be applicable to cities across the country, but then there'll be the much more context-specific things. And again, think of New York City, and it's much more dense. It has many more buildings. And so for them, they might look at solutions like making sure that they have corridors through the city with a high density where air can flow kind of to get the heat out of the city at certain times, where in Tucson or Phoenix, something like that may not be as appropriate. So I think we'll see a lot of context-specific solutions too.
All right. Ladd Keith is an assistant professor at the University of Arizona and was a reviewer on the Urban Land Institute's report called Scorched. We will post a link to it at theshow.kjzz.org. Ladd, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.